Taking a look now at the risks to people and wildlife from synthetic hormone disruptors. Nancy Langston, our guest today, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. She has a joint appointment with the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. And for the last 3 years, she has served as president of the American Society for Environmental History. She's the author of the book we'll be talking about. It's Toxic Bodies, Hormone Disruptors, and the Legacy of DES. This is published by Yale University Press. And certainly as we move along today, I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments and email us. You can do that at talk@wpr.org, or you can call us at our 800 number, 1-800-642-1234. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. Professor Nancy Langston, welcome.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
We were talking just briefly off air, and I said, started to say your book kind of depressed me a little bit. But it would disturb me, but then it also kind of depressed me a little bit, because it seems that our government hasn't always done a very good job on things, and particularly something like DES.
It is a slightly depressing topic. When I started doing research on this, I at times was a little overwhelmed by what I was finding out, that so many of the synthetic chemicals that we've released into the environment since World War II turn out to be enormously beneficial for many things, but also enormously problematic, particularly for the hormone systems of wildlife and people, especially the people that are most vulnerable, the developing infants and the young children.
Let's start at the beginning a little bit. What is DES, and how did it come into use, or when did it come into use in the marketplace?
DES is diethylstilbestrol, which many people no longer have heard of, but was once the most popular synthetic hormone manufactured and produced. It was synthesized in 1938 in England by a great chemist, Charles Dodds. And it was seen as this enormous benefit for women because it was the very first hormone replacement therapy. And at the time, synthetic estrogens really didn't exist. The natural estrogens were very expensive. And no one was really sure how best to treat women who were suffering from some of the symptoms of menopause. So this was seen as a great benefit. And within just a year of its synthesis, many, many manufacturers tried to get the Food and Drug Administration in America to approve its manufacture and marketing to women as a treatment for menopausal symptoms.
And it has it's not worked out very well.
Well, that's something of an understatement, we might say. At first, it was used just as a treatment for menopause, and millions of women took it for a couple years. And then it was used as a synthetic steroid to make livestock, especially cattle and chickens, grow faster so they could be sent to market more quickly. And then, most problematically, it was used as a treatment for pregnant women, at first for diabetic women who had a really hard time carrying a pregnancy to term, but then it was marketed very, very heavily to all pregnant women. It was never really tested. It was never shown to be safe for developing fetuses. And years after it was marketed so heavily, doctors in Boston finally discovered that it was causing vaginal cancers, not in the women who took the drug, but in their developing fetuses when those children became adults. Mm-hmm. So it was one generation displaced. And at that point, over 5 million women had took it while pregnant. And essentially, everyone in America who ate meat had been exposed to the chemical because it was given to 90-some percent of livestock, of beef in particular.
That was a chilling when in your book, there's one point where you say everybody in the country has some of it in their system.
Right. It was one of those enormous experiments. We would love now to step back and compare exposed populations to unexposed populations, as you're supposed to do scientifically, to get some sense what the effects are. But it turns out that's impossible to do because almost everyone in America was exposed. So we can compare the effects of people who know that they took it while pregnant and those who don't know. But many, many women took it without even knowing that they were taking it because it was marketed in vitamins for pregnant women. And so many women had no idea they were taking it. And then everyone in America essentially was exposed to very low levels of it. And we don't really know what those low levels did to people, but we have pretty clear ideas what they did to experimental animals in the laboratory, and that wasn't good.
That wasn't good. I'm going to ask you about that, to talk about that a bit, but let me give the number for you to join in. It's 1-800-642-1234. If you'd like to weigh in on this topic, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call, shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. What happened to those animals?
Well, the laboratory animals, in study after study, were shown to develop cancer. They were shown to develop reproductive abnormalities in their own reproductive systems. And more importantly, if they were pregnant when they were treated with experimental DES, it was found that their offspring developed all sorts of cancers and reproductive problems. The chilling part of this story is that it wasn't just that we discovered this last year, decades after the drug had been given, that almost immediately after the drug was first synthesized in 1938, hundreds of studies were published within just 2 years showing these effects. And yet the Food and Drug Administration still had to decide whether this was safe to give to people or not.
And that's kind of what your story, your book is about, is this whole process. And it really defies logic. There were some individuals that were kind of involved in this and played a pretty heavy role in keeping it going.
Right. There were companies that played a heavy role in promoting DES. There were individuals within the Food and Drug Administration and within the companies who very heavily promoted DES. But one of the reasons I got so interested in this case study was not because DES is such a threat today. There's still residues in the ecosystem, but DES has been banned for most human and livestock uses for quite a while. But I find DES to be such a powerful case study because I think it can really help inform us about drugs that are still in common circulation, about chemicals that are in plastics, about chemicals that are in pesticides. Because the struggles that the government regulatory agencies faced in trying to decide whether DES should be approved or should not be approved are still the questions that we face today. And all too often, people say, well, we don't know for absolutely certain that this chemical is going to hurt people. So let's just approve it and see what happens. And sometimes that's reasonable, but it's only reasonable if we learn from our history, if we learn from past experiences. And DES was a tragedy for many, many people, but it's an incredibly wonderful case study for us to learn from. And I think it's really time for us to learn from it.
Well, let's take some calls. Liz in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Liz. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm a DES baby, and I'm old enough now to have tried to get pregnant on my own, and it was through having failure getting pregnant that I found out that I was a DES baby. And then my mom said, oh, yeah, that's that one thing that I had to take every day when I was pregnant with you. And here's a question for you. During my teenage years, I happened to get pregnant, and I gave this child up for adoption. It was in my later years that I was not able to get pregnant. And I'm wondering now, this young man that I gave up for adoption, does DES affect the male population?
Liz, I'm really, really sorry to hear about your experience, and I'm also really sorry that it's so common today. The question about does DES affect male children, the answer is, unfortunately, yes, it does.
Because he and his new wife now are having trouble getting pregnant.
Yeah.
By the way, there is good news there. I did find him after all many years. So, and he's here in Madison.
Oh, that's great that you found him. And it's really important that he let his doctors know that he is a DES son, and that there are networks of researchers that are looking at fertility effects on DES sons. So if he is interested, it would be really, really beneficial for him to get to inform his primary care provider and also to get involved with these larger questions about research on DES sons.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for the information. What's the title of your book? I just tuned in.
The title of the book is Toxic Bodies, Hormone Disruptors, and the Legacy of DES.
Okay. Well,
fascinating reading.
Thanks.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Well, maybe we could talk a little bit more about endocrine disruptors. Can you explain that whole process a little bit?
Sure. Endocrine disruptors, it's a scientific term for chemicals that have the ability to alter the action of our hormone system in our body. And so these chemicals may act very much as synthetic estrogens, so they may act just like estrogens, or they may actually block hormones in our body, so they may block the thyroid hormones, they may magnify the effects of existing hormones. So there are lots of different ways that a synthetic chemical, and even a natural chemical as well, can alter the effect of hormone systems in our body. But it turns out to be particularly problematic because hormone systems, the endocrine system, is essential in structuring communication in our body and essential in structuring development in fetuses and young children, and essential also in regulating our health within our body.
Yeah. And it also, if I'm not mistaken, may have leaked into our wildlife system as well. You're a forest and wildlife ecology professor, among other things, and you could talk a bit about that too.
Sure. And in fact, some of the first signs that that these synthetic chemicals might actually be affecting hormone systems came from studies that looked at wildlife. Rachel Carson in 1962, in her extraordinary book Silent Spring, talked, of course, a lot about DDT and its effects on wildlife. And she noted that some of the effects of this chemical may be displaced by one generation. So not the adult showing the effects, but the offspring showing the effects. But at the time, she didn't really have a scientific model for imagining how that might happen. And it wasn't for decades later until Professor Theo Colburn started doing a project on Great Lakes wildlife, because lots of people had noticed that wildlife in the Great Lakes, fish, birds, mammals, that lots and lots of different wildlife had different health problems. But these health problems weren't all cancer, or they weren't all developmental problems. Some of them were neurological, problems with brain. Some were problems with behavior. And no one really quite understood how they fit together until Dr. Colburn started noticing that all of these problems were connected by hormones. And so she hypothesized that synthetic chemicals might be disrupting hormone systems and that these chemicals might be abundant in the Great Lakes system.
Our guest today, Nancy Langston. Professor Langston is in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, with a joint appointment in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, and is the author of Toxic Bodies, Hormone Disruptors and the Legacy of DES, published by Yale University Press. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Professor Nancy Langston of the University of Wisconsin-Madison today about her new book. It's titled Toxic Bodies, Hormone Disruptors, and the Legacy of DES. Fascinating book about the history of DES, one of our earliest endocrine-disrupting chemicals to be widely released to the environment. And guess what? Probably almost 100% of the population at one point had some DES. We all had it. If you're a certain age, you probably have had it in your system. And her book is kind of a history of, you know, what happened. It's a case study of what happened with DES, and it makes for fascinating reading. If you'd like to join in, our lines are all filled now, but the number is 1-800-642-1234. You could email us at talk@wpr.org. And I want to go to something I found sad a little bit in the book for you, in a way, was as you were working on this, you ran into some revelations of your own.
Right. Several years ago, when I was in the middle of research for the book, I started having some health problems. And at first, the doctors told me, oh, this is nothing unusual for women of your age in your mid-40s. They were at first fairly completely normal tumors that are called fibroid tumors. So the formal name is uterine leiomyomas. And they're very, very common in women in their 30s and 40s. But they started growing very rapidly. And soon it became clear I would have to have a hysterectomy. And I had a whole host of other issues. And at the same, one of the doctors who examined me said, oh, so your mother took DES. And I said, no, I'm writing a book on DES. I'm not a DES daughter. I don't think so. And I immediately called my mother, and she didn't remember ever having been told by a doctor that she was taking it. So we talked a lot more with the doctors. It turned out they were concerned that I had uterine cancer, and it turned out it wasn't uterine cancer. It was something else. So I'm completely fine now. But in the process of going through a year of what seemed like medical emergencies at the time, a lot of different surgeries, I spent a lot of time talking with my doctors, with my family, with my mother, and realized that all the women in my family have faced various reproductive issues, fertility challenges, miscarriages, suspected uterine cancer. And what's striking about this is that there's nothing the slightest bit unusual about this. This is completely typical for women in my generation in their 40s, for anybody who was exposed to the broader natural environment in the post-war era. My doctors kept saying, oh, this is nothing unusual. We see this all the time. And part of me thought, why is that reassuring? I mean, it's reassuring not to have cancer. It's not reassuring to have a lot of surgeries that it turns out that lots of other people in our world are being exposed to. So now we think it was probably, we looked through my mother's health records and think that she probably did not take DES while she was pregnant with her five children, partly because she was a grad student and couldn't afford any drugs, but more importantly, because she's just pretty certain she didn't take it. And so we're guessing that it was probably background exposure due to the meat that she was eating, just due to the broader environmental exposures. And there's no possible way for anyone to say that any one exposure is the cause of my health issues, any of my health sister's health issues, or anybody in particular's health issues. Anything could have caused breast cancer. Anything could have caused uterine cancer. And that in itself, I think, is very striking and reason for all of us to pay much greater attention to the broader environment and the question of what are we putting into our environment.
Julie in Madison is up next here with a question. Julie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I wanted to ask about something that was made very clear in Theo Kolbern's book, Our Hidden Future, which was published, I think, in the mid-1990s, and I read it because we had a chlorine gas emission problem in our neighborhood, and it was making people nauseous and short of breath, and they were experiencing all kinds of serious health problems. And Dr. Kolbern explained that one of the reasons chlorine and chlorine compounds are so dangerous, especially to women, is that the chlorine molecule is enough like the estrogen one for the estrogen receptors in the body to confuse chlorine with estrogen. And so they're sort of invited in by these receptors, and once they're in the body, they cause all kinds of havoc. And I thought, you know, she really explained exactly how these things work extremely clearly.
Comment, Nancy?
Yeah, that's a fascinating observation, and it points to a really intriguing issue that we face now in regulating so many of these synthetic chemicals, because chlorine, like many other molecules, doesn't look exactly like estrogen or other hormones, but it can bind to the receptors in our bodies and then affect the action of the natural hormones in our own bodies. And so it's been very hard for scientists to figure out, just by looking at a molecule, is it going to act as an estrogen? Is it going to block estrogens? Is it going to act as an anti-estrogen? And so careful studies need to be done to identify which of the current chemicals on the market are toxic. But I think it's a much more productive idea is to actually start by designing chemicals that don't have hormonal properties rather than trying to backtrack and clean up the 60, 70,000 some chemicals that do potentially have these unknown effects.
Yeah. Thank you, Julia, for calling. I want to give Maddie and Oneida a chance to go on next. Maddie, hello to you.
Hi. Before I ask my question, I'd like to say, Larry, that I hope that you will tell people how they can get copies of the recording of these last two programs that you had.
Sure will.
Today, sure. Because we need to share this information with as many people as possible. And my question is, could any of this have anything to do with autism?
DES.
DES and autism.
Or maybe other chemicals.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And the jury is still out on that. There are certainly a lot of signs that rates of autism are actually increasing. Some of that's probably due to better detection, but some of that increase certainly appears to be real. And there are a host of things that could be linked to increases in autism. Environmental issues are certainly of concern. I personally think that it's clear that mercury in vaccines is not one of the causes of the increase in autism. And I think it's really important for people to continue to get vaccinations to provide those enormous health benefits to the community. But I think it's critical that we start looking at environmental correlates, environmental links to autism and to many, many other diseases and illnesses and developmental disruptions that are increasing in the general population. Often these have powerful genetic components, and people tend to say, well, if it's genetic, it can't be environmental. And what we've learned in the past 10 years is that environmental and genetic effects are deeply, deeply linked, that environmental exposures to chemicals can actually change the ways that genes are expressed during development and make people actually much more susceptible to environmental illnesses and probably to illnesses such as autism.
Thank you, Maddie, for your call as well. Lynn and Eau Claire, I want to give you a chance. Lynn, hello.
Hello, Nancy and Larry. 14 months ago, I went to anaphylaxis because of an antibiotic. And I have nothing, you know, I'm not going to name it because it's a useful one. But my body reacted horribly. Since that episode, I'm very, very, almost deathly it. I've had to use my EpiPen dozens of times because of reactions to other things in the environment. I've asked for an explanation of what has happened to me, and it's, well, some people that happens to, and there's millions of things, I'm quoting, of things to be allergic to. So, you know, it's like it takes your chances. I understand what happened on a very basic level, but I don't understand, and it's very difficult to live like this.
It's I'm very sorry, Lynn, for the issues you have, and Nancy, I'm sure you can't probably specifically prescribe or talk to Lynn about her individual situation, but can you talk in general about what may happen under those kinds of circumstances?
Yeah, Lynn, I too am really, really sorry about your experience. It sounds really horrible. And as Larry said, I can't speak to your particular experience. I hope that your health providers have been able to help you some, or at least help you understand ways of reducing your exposures. One of the things that we're seeing is an increase in chemical sensitivities, an increase in the population of people, and particularly women, who seem to have become very, very sensitized to a whole host of chemicals. Sometimes this is an allergic response. Sometimes it's some other kind of an immune response in the body. And what we now know is that various synthetic chemicals can change the way that the immune system works. And that's one of the more frightening things about some of these synthetic chemicals. Health itself is pretty complex, and there are lots of things, natural toxins, lots of natural events that can harm our health. But our bodies have very complex ecosystems of health, our immune systems, mm-hmm. that help restore our health. And what's most disturbing about some synthetic chemicals is that they seem to disrupt our immune systems and either cause them to overreact to new chemicals or sometimes to underreact. And trying to understand how that is working and how to reduce those effects of synthetic chemicals is, I think, a really critical area in environmental medicine.
Hmm. Lynn, I thank you very much for calling. And again, I'm sorry for your condition. I think I hope you get some help on it. Thank you so much. And I have an email here before we go on to Daniel in Rice Lake. I have an email from Jody who says, I was a DES baby, had difficult times carrying pregnancies to term. One child survived, now 19 years old. However, she's had emotional issues, including depressions, anxiety, OCD, has been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, eating disorder, and a schizotypical disorder. We suspect hormone imbalance, food allergies, chemical imbalance. Is there any research on the effects of DES, or could you talk some more about the effects of DES on the second generation? If so, the recommendations for moving forward for health and balance. And I certainly think, Jody, it'd be worth your time to take a look at Nancy's book, for one thing.
Jody, thanks very much for your email. And again, I'm very sorry about the issues that your child is facing right now. The effects on the second generation are indeed pretty profound. And I want to quickly say that certainly everybody doesn't have these effects. In one study, just one study, some 90% of the children sampled had some reproductive, emotional, or physiological effects of DES, but often they were pretty minor. It was things that the children could certainly learn to live with. So I don't want to suggest that everyone is going to be struggling with these issues, but if the child of someone who was exposed to DES while pregnant is facing these issues, the first thing I'd say is it's really critical to let the primary care provider know about that, to get that on the medical records. And then ways of finding balance. Well, you know, that's a huge question. And it's something that I think it's partly up to us as individuals to figure out how we can best find balance. In my own life, I found that eating organic foods, trying to minimize my own exposures to plastics. My husband's an organic farmer, so it's a little easier for me. Mm-hmm. But all of us can make individual choices that reduce our exposure. And reducing continuing exposure is important, even if exposure has already happened as infants, because it's the lifetime cumulative exposure that eventually matters to the next generation. But in addition to these individual choices, trying to find balance, I think it's also really important for all of us to get involved as much as we can in larger political questions and get involved in whatever way we see fit in trying to work with governments and also trying to work with corporations, with governments in better regulation and in better incentives for green chemistry, and with companies as consumers in actually providing a real voice and letting companies know that we don't want these chemicals in our food supply. And we've seen this very powerfully with bisphenol A, which the government has been very slow to regulate, but consumer action has really helped remove it from many, many products.
We did, and BPA, we had an email relating to it. The plastic containing BPA in was or it may be still in I don't think it's in baby bottles anymore. It is. It still is. Lines, canned liners, it's been found to cause cancer, BPA.
BPA is a fascinating chemical.
You write about it near the end of your book.
Near the end of the book. BPA is in many, many ways very similar to DES. BPA was actually synthesized before DES, just a couple years before DES, by the people in the same lab, and they were looking at the carcinogenic effects, the cancer-causing effects of these particular kind of chemicals. So they started looking at this chemical because they knew it caused cancer, and then they realized it was this really powerful estrogen. And so BPA was, in some ways, the very first synthetic estrogen ever manufactured. But then the same lab discovered that DES that they just synthesized was an even more powerful estrogen. So they put BPA aside for the time being. And it wasn't for a couple decades until another lab realized that if they polymerized this chemical, they formed long chains, then it formed these wonderful plastics called polycarbonates and Lexan. And we know those as our Nalgene bottles and so many products that until the last year or so were in everyday use. As you mentioned, they lined food cans. They were used on children's teeth and still often are used on children's teeth to prevent cavities. They were in many water bottles. They were in many medical apparatuses. They were in baby bottles. And right now, it's still really not regulated in America. Different companies have decided to remove it from some products. Some local jurisdictions have actually outlawed it in baby products, but on a national level, it's still out there. And what's so fascinating is it's in many, many powerful ways a direct parallel to DES.
Yes.
Its effects on the body are almost identical in many ways. And so what I'm arguing is that we can't legally or ethically do the direct experiments on fetuses, on developing children, to see if it causes cancer. It's just not legal, and it's completely unethical. But in effect, we're doing this by this huge international experiment. And so instead of repeating the tragedy of DES, what I'm arguing is that we simply look at what happened with DES and stop repeating history over and over again to learn from our mistakes. There are plenty of alternatives that appear much, much safer.
And I think one of the slight differences here between BPA and DES is that we got an immediate public outcry, or maybe not immediate, but we got a public outcry more so than I think we did. It took a longer time for DES to get a public outcry.
Yes, I think you're right about that, Larry. One of the things I found so fascinating in looking at the history of DES was how difficult it was for the regulatory agencies to actually act on the knowledge that they had. What we hear a lot of times from governments, from chemical companies, from our mothers, is, well, if a chemical is on the market, it must be safe. People assume that if they can go to the store and buy something in the supermarket in Ashland or the hardware store, that somebody must have shown this chemical is safe. And what we know is often, unfortunately, that's not true. There are lots and lots of things on the market which have never really been tested. And there are lots of things on the market which there were enormous debates about whether they should be released onto the market, especially for drugs. So DES three times came before the Food and Drug Administration in the 1940s and 1950s. Three times the Food and Drug Administration said no. We need to act with precaution. This chemical has too many effects on animal studies. It's not safe. It hasn't been shown to be safe for people. And three times political pressure was put on the FDA to change its decision and to release it onto the market. And each time they said, well, we're not so sure about this, but we'll just sort of do this as an experiment, see what happens, and take it off the market if there are bad effects. But each time it was very, very hard for them to stand up to their principles of being cautious to protect the consumer. So one of the lessons from DES history is these regulatory agencies have tried so hard to protect consumer and public health, but it's really hard for them to do it. And we really need to support them in their efforts and, you know, put pressure on the government and on industry to really stand up for public health.
It's, is there a solution to that? Can we make those organizations or those bureaucracies within the government independent? No, not likely, Larry, probably.
No, actually, both my parents work for the regulatory agencies. My mother was director of research for Consumer Product Safety Commission for a while. My father was with the USDA. And I grew up in Washington, D.C. neighborhood where everybody worked for the government, for a regulatory agency. So unlike many people, I think they're wonderful, wonderful people in our government agencies, in our regulatory bureaucracies. I don't think bureaucracy is a bad word. I think they're great scientists. I think they're great administrators, really struggling to make good decisions with insufficient knowledge. Often we don't have the whole picture because it's impossible to get every bit of data about, a new chemical. And yet we still have to make a decision that protects health and at the same time doesn't stifle innovation. So if we're too cautious, then, good drugs would never get on the market. But if we're not cautious enough, then all sorts of chemicals get on the market that shouldn't be there. So trying to find some kind of wise balance is really difficult. But I think it's possible. We can certainly find examples where eventually risky chemicals were taken off the market. We can find great examples where risky chemicals were not allowed onto the market. There are lots of heroes in my story. It's not completely a depressing story.
No, it's not.
There's some amazing heroes who worked for these agencies, scientists, regulators, who really stood up for public health and really made difficult decisions that protected untold numbers of people and wildlife in our country and in the globe.
And yet many people were, on the other hand, many people were have been affected. I have some good friends who the wife took thalidomide back when, and a child was born with a large hole in its heart and died after surgery. So for the people like that, it's pretty hard to rationalize politics with science, and the politics and science don't mix very well. But you've done a marvelous job in your book of describing this process, and I think it's great for people to understand what happens in a case like this with DES, and as you talk about BPA as well, and it's a real learning experience for me, and I thank you so much for writing it and for coming by today to be with us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Nancy Langston is author of the book Toxic Bodies, Hormone Disruptors and the Legacy of DES. It's published by Yale University Press. I really apologize for not getting to everybody, but that's just the way it works here on the Ideas Network. Maybe we can get her back and talk with her again. Thanks so much to you for listening. And tomorrow we'll take a look at constructing better buildings through sound energy. That's one of the topics. In the meantime, thanks for listening here on the Ideas Network.